For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. As we near the end of Women's History Month, we're exploring on today's program the life and legacy of two fascinating women. In part one, you're going to learn the story of the innovative woman who invented the Barbie doll, the most famous doll in the world. In part two, you'll hear about the rather mysterious story of one of the most gifted athletes of the 20th century, tennis legend Alice Marble. Here's part one.
What an intriguing story is before us today. And the title of the book does not fully tell the story, Barbie and Ruth. Well, maybe when you hear the name Barbie, you do have some sense. We are going to be talking today about the Barbie doll and about the woman who helped create her. Barbie and Ruth, the story of the world's most famous doll and the woman who created her. Robin Gerber has written a fascinating book here about Ruth Handler, who is the woman largely responsible for that iconic doll called the Barbie doll. And it's a story not only about that, about a groundbreaking development in the toy business, in the doll business, but also the story of a woman at the top of a company at a time when that was exceedingly uncommon. It is also, unfortunately, a story that does not end very happily. It is the story of Mattel and of some great difficulties which they experience, getting a little too big, maybe a little too quickly, or growing in ways that prove to be unwise. A complicated story which Robin Gerber helps us to untangle. Her previous books include Leadership the Eleanor Roosevelt Way, Timeless Strategies from the First Lady of Courage, Katharine Graham, The Leadership Journey of an American Icon, and a novel called Eleanor versus Ike. And she is a lawyer and senior faculty for the Gallup Organization, a senior fellow in the executive education at the Robert H. Smith School of Business at the University of Maryland. And I am very happy to be speaking with her about her fascinating book, Barbie and Ruth, published by HarperCollins. Robin Gerber, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thanks for having me.
I have to say, I got a couple of long looks from people at the health club as I read this book on the treadmill. I mean, as they kind of spot the cover and see that image of the lower part of one leg of a Barbie doll. But my word, this is a fascinating story. How did you first become acquainted with the story of Ruth Handler, and at what point did it become apparent to you that this was a story worth telling in this kind of detail?
Well, I first learned about Ruth Handler from a book, actually, that was put out called Enterprising Women, about other women business owners. And she was in this book, and I thought, oh, this is interesting. The Barbie doll was actually created by a woman. I had no idea. And then as I investigated, I discovered that she had also founded Mattel Toy Company, one of the great American companies. And then, of course, as I read more about her story, I learned that besides building this great company and doing lots of innovative things as a business person, she then had this tragic fall from grace where she overextended the company, as you alluded to, and was convicted of fraud, and also had breast cancer at the same time. So this terribly tragic period in her life. But then she redeems herself, comes back, founds a new company making prosthetic inserts for women lost their breast to cancer and really becomes a hero to breast cancer survivors. And 10 years ago at Barbie's 40th anniversary celebration, Mattel had her sitting at the head table. So it's a great story of success and failure and coming back.
Hmm. It's also the story of an intriguing partnership and marriage between she and her husband, Elliot. Talk for just a moment about what an intriguing pair they were and of how important he was in this story and in the story of the Barbie doll.
Yes, it's a wonderful love story. We're coming up to Valentine's Day, so it's appropriate to talk about that part of it. They met, they were both children of immigrants, of Polish-Jewish immigrants living in Denver. They met when they were 16 years old, and they were together for over 65 years. Elliot was a wonderful designer and artist, very creative person, but a very, very shy person. Ruth used to say he couldn't order his own food in a restaurant, but she believed in him every one of those years, and when he started making things, she said, I'm going to sell these. It started with ashtrays and trinkets made out of a new plastic material called Lucite, and, of course, then ended up with toys.
I want to read a description you give us of their partnership. You say Ruth and Elliot's unique partnership established many of its patterns in those early days. She had an optimistic view no matter the situation and kept Elliot's spirits up. She had a boisterous adventurism that pulled him along, and he had a quiet, steady, unwavering love for her. And at the end of their work days, there was much to talk, share, and dream about. I mean, I think many partnerships are, in a sense, unlikely in the way that this one was. I mean, kind of odd pairings, balancing of opposites, and so on. But it's really fascinating to be able to follow this partnership and to see how it worked for these two.
Yes, it was very complementary in the way that they sort of filled in each other's gaps, I guess you could say. And, you know, certainly Ruth was a lot more volatile and quick to react, quick to get angry, and Elliot was always the calm one. He was the one, the very, very steady one. But as that passage suggests, he was also the one who didn't have that kind of absolute optimism, absolute confidence that I think you need if you're going to found a business and build a huge business like she did.
By the way, tell us about his name. I mean, what his name ultimately became.
Oh, that is an interesting story. He was, as a young man, he was called Izzy because his name was Itzhak Elliot Handler. And in the community where he grew up, they called him Izzy as a nickname. And when they were driving across the desert after they were married, to live in Los Angeles, Ruth turns to him and she says, I'd like you to start calling yourself Elliot now that we're starting a new life. Because Izzy, frankly, sounds too Jewish. And she was concerned about anti-Semitism. She'd experienced some anti-Semitism against her brother, who was nicknamed Muzzy, and some police officers. There had been an incident where they had made fun of him for that name in a very anti-Semitic way. And so I think she was worried about it, and it made her uncomfortable going to this new place. She wasn't, I think they were, you know, as many children of immigrants, they were trying to fit in. And so she said, would you change your name and start calling yourself Elliot? I like it a lot better. Hmm. And he said, sure. So he started to be called Elliot.
You say unconsciously they were moving away from their roots and edging closer to assimilation, heading toward a storybook realization of the American dream. They are in Los Angeles, I believe, as this business venture first gets underway. And I want you to tell our listeners the fascinating story about the first order which was placed for some of their goods at a moment in time when they didn't even have letterhead or anything official to even write down an order. Tell our listeners that great story.
Oh, yes. Well, Ruth went into a very high-end store, you know, a very fancy gift shop in Los Angeles, and just marches in with some of Elliot's designs. Now, at this point, he is making things out of Lucite that are really like ashtrays, bookends, just kind of, incidental sort of small items. And she takes these into the store and she says, you know, you ought to buy these. And the owner of the store says, well, I have to come and see your workshop. Well, their workshop was basically a garage, a messy garage. And so she says, well, come on Saturday, because she wants to be there. And she had a day job at Paramount Studios. So, and she figures Elliot can't handle this, you know. So this man shows up and he looks around. He says, fine, you know, I'll place an order. It was their first order. For them, it was rather large. And Elliot realizes in a panic, he doesn't even have a piece of paper. So he sort of grabs, tears off the end of a bag or something and writes down this order. And as soon as this man leaves, they just are jumping up and down and screaming because this is actually the first order of what would eventually become Mattel Toy Company.
Tell us about that jump which they make from household items into the toy business.
Yeah. Well, what happens is they're making these items, and Ruth actually gets pregnant and has to stay home, so she can't be part of that company. Elliot gets a partner, and they form a company called Elzac, which is making these trinkets and women's jewelry, costume jewelry. And Ruth, meanwhile, can't really stand staying home, so she's going to go back into business, and she decides to sell, again, some of Elliot's designs, which were picture frames. But he is also tinkering on the side with making dollhouse furniture out of these little pieces of scrap wood and other materials. And sure enough, she finds she can sell the dollhouse furniture. So that was really the first kind of toy that they made. And Elliot just liked toys. When I interviewed him, he said, well, I'm really a kid at heart. I still love toys.
Hmm. We're speaking with Robin Gerber, and we're talking about her book, Barbie and Ruth. So one of the most interesting breakthroughs which occurs with this development of this thing which came to be known as the Barbie doll was an entirely new idea about what a doll should be and what kind of dolls girls would most enjoy playing with. This is one of the most basic things that I never knew until I read your book. Until the Barbie doll came along, what kind of dolls did girls play with?
Yeah, if you were a little girl, as I was in the 1950s, you could really, to actually play with a three-dimensional doll, you would get a baby doll. That's what you would get. And so you would play it being mommy. And that was it. Really wasn't much else you could play at when you had a baby doll. But Ruth noticed that her daughter and her friends were often playing with paper dolls, because paper dolls, of course, were adult dolls. And I remember also playing with paper dolls for that same reason, that I wanted to play at being an adult. And Ruth saw this and said, well, little girls really want to play at being big girls. Let's give them a doll to do it with. But it took her quite a while, a number of years, to convince her designers that mothers would possibly buy a doll for their daughters that had breasts. The men just couldn't imagine such a thing happening.
You know, it's really interesting to think about. As she observed this, her daughter and her friends playing with these flimsy paper dolls and mimicking adult conversation and, I mean, taking on the role of grown-up women and obviously enjoying it, you know, she realizes if girls find themselves wanting to do that with something like a paper doll, imagine what they might do if they had something more realistic in their hands. I mean, realistic, I suppose, with quotes around it, but I mean, what if they had a real doll versus a paper doll? I mean, what a brilliant insight that is.
Yeah, and I think, as I say in the book, I think it was, she always said, oh, I thought of this because I saw my daughter playing with paper dolls. But I think there was something deeper going on, which is that she was a little girl who always wanted to be a bigger girl. And she didn't play at it because she was the 10th child of her parents and last child. Her mother was ill after she was born and gave her to be raised by her oldest sister. Now, this sister never had other children and worked all the time with her husband, owned a store, owned a deli counter. And when she was 10 years old, Ruth said to her sister/mother, I want to go to work. And at 10 years old, she was working behind the counter in this deli, and she describes not really having many friends, and she just loved to work and be around adults. So if you think about it, she was that little girl who wanted to be a big girl. So I think that was where the insight really came from.
Now, she has this idea that Mattel should make a new kind of doll, but unfortunately, she is unable to convince her own designers that it makes sense or that it can be done. Tell us about the discovery she makes during a trip to Europe, which, in a sense, ends up making all the difference in making all this happen.
Yes, it did, because these male designers at Mattel did not want to make this doll. They gave her all kinds of excuses. You know, one excuse was that they couldn't mold such a doll with these tiny hands and feet with the current kind of plastics that they had at the time in the molding processes, or that it would cost too much money to do it. Well, then she goes on a trip to Europe in 1955 with her family, and in a toy shop window in Luzern, Switzerland, sees a doll that you and I would think of as Barbie. But in fact, this doll started its life a few years before that as the three-dimensional realization of a cartoon character, and a very popular cartoon character named Lily in one of the German newspapers. And Lily in the cartoons is actually a prostitute. And the cartoonist who made this cartoon had the idea that men would like a gag toy of Lily. And so Lily was born as a gag sex toy for men. But even in Europe, little girls saw this toy doll and said, I want that. And so it had gradually worked its way into toy shops, and that's when Ruth found the doll, brought it home. Her daughter wanted one. She got one for her daughter, two for herself. Went back to Mattel and handed it to her designer and said, figure out how to make this. This is the doll I've been talking about.
Well, and of course, when you hand over a doll to somebody who says it can't be done, that's all the proof you need that in fact it can be done. I mean, somebody is doing it, and we need to do it too.
Exactly.
By the way, you do make mention at some point that ultimately the company responsible for the Lily doll goes after Mattel. I mean, believing, and to some extent probably quite rightly, that their idea and design had, in a sense, been stolen.
Yes. Well, it was, wasn't it? And they did. They brought a suit. They went through various machinations. But at the end of the day, Mattel bought the rights to the Lily doll for about $20,000.
Getting these actually made is an interesting challenge, and you tell us that some of the complications came because much of the manufacturing actually occurred in Japan, and due to the language and cultural barriers of the time, there were some interesting mistakes made and miscommunications in terms of very important details, including some important details of Barbie's body.
Exactly. This was the beginning of, you know, companies going to Japan for the cheap workforce over there. And so Mattel had done this. They had started going to Japan to manufacture toys. This was a new kind of plastic they were using, a new kind of molding process. Actually, the Japanese didn't know how to do it any better than the Americans, and so the engineers were struggling over there to figure out how to make this doll. And as you say, they were also struggling to understand what this doll was supposed to look like. The Japanese really didn't like this doll very much. They didn't like her looks. And they kept forming her with nipples on those breasts. And Mattel didn't quite want to go that far. And so finally, Jack Ryan, who was the engineer in charge of this over in for Mattel over in Japan, one day he just got so frustrated, he took out a file and just filed off those nipples so that the Japanese would finally understand that Barbie was just supposed to have those smooth breasts that we know that she has today. So there were definitely some humorous missteps.
Right. And, of course, you outline other important details such as the rotational molding, which gave Barbie that ability to move and twist and so on, which we know very well. Of course, another big breakthrough, besides the fact that Barbie is an adult, is also the fact that she would have all of these different outfits, all of these different sorts of clothes. That's the kind of thing we just take for granted now. It's just such a ubiquitous part of the doll business, but apparently this was quite unprecedented, at least here in America.
Yeah, that was another great innovation of Ruth's. From the minute she saw that Lily doll, she went in and she said, okay, I'd like these three dolls, and then I'd like some more outfits. And they said, oh, no, there's no other outfits. You buy the doll. You want another outfit? You buy another doll. And Ruth said, thought to herself, well, that's the stupidest thing in the world. Let's just sell the doll, and we'll make all kinds of clothes. And children can just buy the other clothes, which, of course, was the genius of this. It was the razor blade theory, as Elliot liked to say. Once you buy the razor, you got to get those razor blades.
Mm-hmm. And
so this is a huge part, of course, of the Barbie market, became the pieces of clothing that you could get. And even today, a doll is quite cheap. You can get a Barbie for as cheap as $5. But then the company knows you're going to buy all those clothes and accessories.
Hmm. So it is successful fairly soon, but not immediately. Tell us about at least the brief hesitancy on the part of stores to purchase and stock this doll.
Yeah, well, in the beginning, it was quite a shock for Ruth. She unveiled the doll March 9th, 1959, at the Toy Fair, had a big, beautiful display for Barbie, and all these male buyers came in from the stores, including Sears, which was a very big buyer at the time. And they looked at this doll and turned up their noses and walked out, and she got very few orders and was absolutely devastated, calling Japan in a panic because she'd ordered so much inventory. And the worst thing in the toy business is to have inventory that you can't get out of the warehouse. Well, she had also done something very innovative, which was to make a television commercial for this doll that really portrayed Barbie as a real person. And no doll had ever been advertised this way. And after Toy Fair, little girls started seeing this television ad. Not too much happened for a couple of months, but then they got out of school. And once they were out of school for summer break, they started demanding this doll from their parents, and suddenly demand shot up, and it took 3 years for Mattel to actually catch up with demand after that.
It's probably important for us to understand, too, that that this doll was being marketed in a way that was quite unprecedented, that if I remember correctly, commercials before then had decidedly been pointed at parents, and these were commercials which were designed with little kids in mind.
Yes, we have Ruth Handler to thank for that. That actually started in 1955 when Disney started that show, The Mickey Mouse Club. And for the first time, they offered the opportunity to toy companies to advertise for the entire year. In fact, you had to advertise for the entire year if you wanted to advertise on the Mickey Mouse Club. Now, toy companies had never done that. They only advertised right before Christmas. And actually, they didn't go on TV very often. They mostly advertised in catalogs. And some people will remember those catalogs were aimed at parents, advising parents what toys to buy for their kids, so that children were not really being considered as consumers. Ruth changed all that, and we might love her or hate her for it, but she bought into the Mickey Mouse Club, bet her whole worth of her company, $500,000, to buy those ads for a year, and of course it paid off magnificently.
But it did
change the way toys were sold, because now ads were aimed at kids, and kids were the ones demanding what would be bought.
In fact, someone who worked for her told a reporter, and you quote him this way, that retailers were irked because television advertising undercut their influence in the industry. The ads forced them to buy what Mattel advertised, that is, the stores. It used to be store buyers dictated what toys would sell, meaning the stores themselves. But Mattel reversed that, and all of this became much more public-driven. Which is,
exactly.
And again, that's the kind of thing that we can't even imagine that world because it is so much the reverse, and we are so entrenched in exactly the opposite.
Yeah, and also the idea that this really single-handedly, Ruth Handler did make this change, and there are many books that credit Mattel and, you know, her this change that she made and she came up with. She had the vision, and this is, you know, the thing about founders of companies, people who build great companies, having that big vision of how things can be changed to benefit their company.
So she goes on to design variations on Barbie, and of course, along comes Ken and Skipper and others, and all kinds of things. Eventually, Mattel expands into other ventures, including Hot Wheels, which are incredibly popular and successful. Then things begin to go wrong. In whatever time remains to us, tell us about kind of the way in which all of this falls apart.
Yeah, well, in 1970, Ruth believes that Mattel's a $300 million company and there's just no more room to grow. And so she has the idea to start buying up other companies. Ringling Brothers Circus became a Mattel company. They bought a movie company, made the movie Sounder. But they were buying these companies with Mattel stock, which was very highly valued. And then comes a bad quarter. Profits are down. Can't let Wall Street know because that'll sink the stock price. And so Ruth cooks the books and is caught in doing this along with some of her other executives and is convicted of SEC of fraud by the Securities and Exchange Commission. Ends up with the longest community service sentence ever given to a white-collar criminal up to that time. But lucky she didn't go to jail. Hmm. I think the judge actually took pity on her because during this terrible ordeal with the company, she also got breast cancer.
That gives us
and
the opportunity.
She lost a breast.
Let's talk then just briefly about Nearly Me, which is a very important undertaking for her.
Well, when terrible things happen to people, they can do all kinds of things and crawl into holes, but that wasn't Ruth's way. She went back to her core skills, building a company, and she founded a new company, as you said, Nearly Me, making breast prosthetics inserts for bras for women who'd had mastectomies like herself. She built a woman-owned company, went around and fitted women personally, had a great experience for herself, and just became a hero to women who had suffered from breast cancer and losing a breast because now they could look good again and have their dignity back. So it was a great redemptive thing that she did for herself and for other women.
Much more in the pages of this fascinating book, Barbie and Ruth, published by HarperCollins. Robin Gerber, I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to The Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're celebrating Women's History Month today with two interviews out of The Morning Show archives. Here's part two. For the next few minutes, we're going to be delving into the remarkable life and, to some extent, mystery-shrouded life of one of the legendary athletes of the 20th century, an amazing woman by the name of Alice Marble. And during the height of her career in the late 1930s, she was, without a doubt, both the finest and the most famous woman tennis player in the world. In fact, perhaps at the height of her powers, she was more famous than any other tennis player in the world. But there is much more to Alice Marble's life than just her prowess on the tennis court, which is the reason why the new book by Robert Weintraub is so fascinating. It is titled The Divine Miss Marble, A Life of Tennis, Fame, and Mystery. And the book is published by Dutton, and we have a few minutes to speak with Robert Weintraub about his book and about the experience of trying to probe into some of the mysteries that have long surrounded the figure of Alice Marble. Robert Weintraub, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
So tell us what you knew about Alice Marble ahead of undertaking this project. And what did you know at that point in terms of the questions that surrounded her?
Well, I knew probably as much as most of your listeners know about her, which is very little, to be totally honest. I knew the name, and that was about it. I knew she was a star tennis player from the distant past, and not much more about her. And then I, you know, started to delve into her life, and it was just one extraordinary occurrence after another. You mentioned that she was a great player. She was so much more than that, of course, but just to start with her on-court achievements, you know, there was really two eras, the pre-Alice Marble era and then the post-Alice Marble era. And the first was when players mainly hit from the baseline and wore calf-length skirts and were coquettish and it was a very dainty game, I guess you'd say, and Alice came along and she was a tornado on the court of physical power and speed, and she wore shorts, which was a scandal when she first appeared on the court with her legs bare, but pretty soon everybody realized it was a major advantage and followed suit, and of course she looked great wearing them, so she became very, very popular just for her physical appearance for a short time, and then when she started winning championships, she became even more popular. And she was laid up with various amounts of travails over her life, and the first main one in terms of tennis was she lost 2 years of her burgeoning career to tuberculosis, and she was in a sanitarium laid up for months at a time. And she came back from that to win the U.S. Nationals, what we call today the U.S. Open in New York, in 1936, and really became a superstar at that point, and went on to win 18 total titles in majors, including doubles. And then at the height of her power, of course, World War II came along and really put the curtain down on what otherwise would have been a career that we would know about even to this day. She would have won quite a bit more championships had she been able to play, but the war ended her career, but it allowed her to pivot in many different directions, which she already had started to do. And it, in some ways, made her even more famous, and as we'll get to, also brought up some mysteries about her life that I got to delve into.
One of the things we should say about her, the early part of her life, is that there is a real shift between where she was born and first grew up and then where her family moved. And this marked a drastic shift in sort of what her daily life would be, and in a sense really helps point the direction of who she was ultimately going to become.
Yeah, she was born in the mountains along the California-Nevada border, the Sierra Range there. And when she was still a child, the family moved to San Francisco, and this became, you know, sort of her playground. Unfortunately, she was hit. Her father passed away in the aftermath of another pandemic, the 1918-19 Spanish flu pandemic. So there's a little tie-in there with what we're going through today. And she, you know, the family really fell on hard times. They had very little money, and Alice wound up, you know, making her way just based on her athletic prowess. And she wound up playing tennis at the Golden Gate Park, which soon was, you know, topped by the Golden Gate Bridge. But when she started playing, there was no bridge quite yet. And she, you know, really helped her in her career. It was a hard scrabble way to learn the game. And most people who played, you know, competitive championship tennis came up through the rich country club, you know, sort of elite settings. And she came up the exact opposite way. And that really helped her when it came time to play against the top level competition. She, because of the way, you know, she had to kind of battle through just her learning of the game and the way that she, you know, started to play on cement courts with cracks and weather-beaten, you know, area that she did, she really had an advantage when it came time to play against some of the other people who weren't quite as tough as she was when it came to that. So she was, you know, came out of California, which was certainly not the epicenter of sporting prowess as it is now. And she had a lot to overcome in that sense, too. But true to Alice's life, she overcame it and became the champion that she was.
One point of kind of delicious irony is you tell us that I believe it was her gifted athletic brother, Dan, who introduced her to tennis. And one of the reasons he did so was because Alice was so good at this plethora of other sports, even baseball. And but Dan regarded tennis as something that could be a little more sort of properly ladylike and maybe more appropriate. Little did he have any way of knowing that there would be nothing ladylike at all about the way she ultimately played the game.
Yes, it is ironic. As you say, she was such a baseball fan and player that she was really kind of the mascot of the local minor league team in San Francisco, who was at the time a very, you know, high-level team before the majors expanded out west. The San Francisco Seals, they made her, you know, kind of their unofficial mascot when Alice was only 12 or 13, and she, you know, had a rifle arm and was one of the best pitchers, even pitched for her high school team on the boys' team, and excelled at pretty much every sport she ever took up. And tennis, as you say, was introduced to her as a way not only to be more ladylike, but I think, you know, as a sport that she could, you know, follow and achieve some level of fame, unlike baseball or basketball in those days, you know, that those were closed sports to women, and something that she could play well on into her later life as well. So it was a wise move by her brother, but I think Alice was already kind of got that drift herself as well, and had realized that tennis was her way out of the streets, so to speak.
Of course, the single person who has more than anything to do with Alice Marble's rise to greatness as a tennis player is her immortal coach, Eleanor Tennant, or Teach Tennant, who unfortunately is a largely forgotten figure. And I should mention just parenthetically that before I was able to access a copy of your book and I was just reading up on Alice Marble, I looked her up on Wikipedia. Of course, that's the place a lot of people start. And Teach Tennant is not even mentioned in the Wikipedia article about Alice Marble, and that is such an injustice. I'm glad that in your book you spend plenty of time talking about this woman and about their very close and often complicated relationship. Tell us about Teach Tennant, and in particular, how she was, in some ways at least, something like Alice Marble.
Yeah, they really had a lot in common. Tennant was also from San Francisco and came up really from nothing and used tennis as a way to increase her you know, her wealth in life. She became a teacher, kind of talked her way into becoming the tennis pro at the old Beverly Hills Hotel. And through that became a teacher of the, you know, rich and famous in the Hollywood colony, the old Hollywood stars, including Carol Lombard, who gave her the nickname Teach, Clark Gable, Errol Flynn, Marlena Dietrich. I mean, just bold-faced names that are still obviously well-known today. And through them, you know, Alice, by proxy, became very close with a lot of them, especially Carol Lombard, who they regarded each other as sisters. And Eleanor was a very unusual woman. She had a very unusual way of speaking, her own kind of patois. And she, more than anything else, wanted to take a star, a player of raw material who came from somewhat similar background as her, basically nothing, and, you know, kind of mold this champion in Eliza Doolittle form. And Alice was that player. And the two of them had a, you know, very, very close. They were joined at the hip, basically, for about the entire decade of the 30s and into the 40s. And it was this Svengali kind of puppet sort of relationship for a long time. When Alice was laid up in the sanitarium, Eleanor paid all her bills. And from then on, Alice was basically in hock to Eleanor. And she worked the entire rest of her life almost to pay her off. And the two of them were certainly known to be very, very, very close, and most people assumed lovers. They always denied it, but under the surface, there was no question that they were certainly in love and had that sort of special bond that is almost closer than love between a coach and an athlete who achieved this rarest of amazing, you know, get to the very height of their chosen profession. And, you know, as you would expect from a relationship that was so close, the two of them then had a very passionate and volatile sort of breaking up, if you will, and came apart during the war over several issues. But Alice mainly felt it was time that she stepped off on her own and lived her own life rather than constantly doing whatever Eleanor Tennant told her to do. But it was certainly a profitable and fruitful relationship before that, and the two of them made history in all kinds of ways.
You've already touched on the fact that one of the most remarkable aspects of what Alice Marble managed to achieve as a tennis player is that it involved an absolutely incredible comeback from a very serious bout with tuberculosis. Tuberculosis is, of course, one of those things where most of us have heard the name but really don't understand what it means. Just briefly, explain how seriously ill Alice Marble was and just how remarkable her comeback from tuberculosis turned out to be.
Yeah, it really got started the year before when she was forced by the kind of tyrant head of the USTA at the time, a man named Julian Myrick, to qualify for the forerunner of, you know, the international competition she would be involved in to play. Alice was forced to play four matches in the same day in 110-degree temperatures in New York. So she collapsed almost immediately after that, and from then on had felt, you know, very poorly for the next few months. Then she went to France, and collapsed on the clay courts there at the Roland Garros Stadium. And she was diagnosed shortly afterward with tuberculosis, which is, at the time, you know, if not a death sentence, pretty close to it. The lungs were certainly affected badly, and, you know, even if she survived, she was told straight away her tennis career, her sporting career was over. Nobody ever came back from a disease of the lungs like that. You know, we see sort of echoes of it now with the COVID-19. Even if you survive, there's obviously damage to the lungs, and nobody really knows what the long-term effects will be, even of fine-tuned athletes getting it. So you can imagine in the 30s, with a woman player who was still very young, only 21, Alice was essentially told that her tennis career, which was still promising, was over almost straight away. And she refused to take no for an answer and got better. And Eleanor kind of broke her out of the sanitarium, and the two of them took on what was at the time an unusually forward-thinking physical training program, something you would more closely see today, involving, you know, lifting weights and jumping rope and cardiovascular fitness, things that we take for granted now, obviously, but at the time, for a woman especially, were very unusual. And Alice, being Alice, she clawed her way right back to the top of the sport, and 2 years later, after collapsing on the grounds of the stadium in Paris, took the championship in Forest Hills, New York, the U.S. Nationals. And it was really an extraordinary event and catapulted her to superstardom, even beyond just what winning the tournament would have done. She became, you know, an incredible comeback story in the eyes of the nation. And everybody saw her as somebody who, you know, kind of overcame not just her own physical travails, but the depression that was crushing the country at the time. And she was held up as a kind of an exemplar of somebody who, you know, refused to lose, to use a cliche.
Right. She, of course, achieves the pinnacle of success in her sport in 1939 with great wins at both the U.S. Open and Wimbledon, and again wins the U.S. Open in 1940, although by that point, thanks to World War II, there is no Wimbledon championship for her to win, and indeed, amateur tennis all but vanishes during the war years. And Alice Marble has to, in a sense, rewrite who she is going to be. And although she plays professional tennis for a short time, even those kind of activities are sharply curtailed by the advent of the Second World War. Explain to our listeners some of the questions that surround exactly what Alice Marble did during those World War II years. This in and of itself is so fascinating.
Yeah, well, at the end of her life, she wrote a memoir which detailed some of the things that she said happened to her, which included an engagement and secret marriage to a combat pilot who subsequently was shot down in the skies of Europe. As a result, she was then kind of motivated by vengeance to take on a mission asked of her to do by U.S. intelligence to go to Switzerland and look up a different former lover who was a Swiss banker and, you know, was working at laundering funds of the Nazis who were trying to, at that point, escape Germany and set up something for themselves in post-war life. And then she would gather the evidence, which would be used at Nuremberg against this banker, and she claims was shot in the back as a result of this chase away from this man's chateau by a Russian double agent who wanted the same material from her. Now, an incredible story, and how much of it has actually happened is certainly open to debate. I could prove very little of it actually happening, to the point where it occurs that she did marry, or at least have an affair with a pilot during the war, but a different pilot, one not the one that she names in her memoir and not someone who was killed in the skies over Europe. And more than likely had an affair with an actual Nazi party member, not a banker who was working with the Nazis, but somebody who was actually one of the nefarious crew that pretty much started the war in Europe. And that's something you can imagine she would want to keep hidden for most of her life. And so, you know, you have to put it in context. When she wrote this, as I say, she made no money from her tennis greatness because of the amateur status of the sport during her time, and really lived on the margins for much of her life afterward. In the 50s, 60s, and 70s, she was, you know, poor and living in California in the desert, kind of a kept figure by one of her former billionaire boyfriends. And, you know, she always wanted to give the fans what they wanted. That was her sort of, you know, kind of approach to life. She was very outgoing in that sense and always put on a show. And I think she embellished a little bit in her memoir just at the end to partially give, you know, the people what they wanted, to sell some extra books maybe, and to, you know, kind of remind people that who she was, and she was a somebody. And if it didn't exactly happen the way she put it down in the memoir, you know, she certainly had some interesting and incredible adventures during the war, and an incredible life as well. And, if, you know, memoir is in the eye of the beholder, as we've seen from many of those examples over the years. So I came in with my 50,000-foot view to sort of try and separate fact from fiction and be non-judgmental in the event of it at all as well.
I think you approach that question with great sensitivity, and it's also fun to read about some of the lengths to which you went in trying to really uncover definitive certainty about exactly what Alice Marble had done and when and where and so on. In our closing minute or so, help our listeners understand the scope of her celebrity at the height of her fame, particularly the kind of fame that she enjoyed among the Hollywood elite. I think it's sometimes a little hard for us to understand how such a thing was possible, but that, of course, was a very different era.
Yeah, and a lot of it stemmed from the fact that she wasn't paid for winning these tournaments. And so it was sort of assumed that she would need the kind of backing of the, you know, the elite in business and in entertainment and, you know, various other forms. And, you know, one of her huge benefactors in that sense was William Randolph Hearst, who invited her to stay at San Simeon whenever she wanted. And, you know, many other billionaires up and down the East Coast who would put her up when she was preparing for these tournaments. And, you know, through Eleanor knowing all these Hollywood jet setters and, you know, hanging out with them. It was ironic because at the same time, she couldn't afford to even, you know, open up her own bank account. She was sort of living in the, you know, the draft of all these incredible names. She had a Zelig-like existence in a lot of ways where she was sort of always at the right hand of some of these great names without ever really, you know, kind of gaining their lifelong, you know, fame and certainly none of the fortune that came with it. But she was extremely well-known at the time. She was, you know, Athlete of the Year, according to the AP, in both 1939 and 1940, and considered sort of beyond sports because of her relationships with these elites, especially the Hollywood elite, and because of, you know, her dazzling, not just beauty, but sort of all-American way about her. You know, she was considered sort of the it girl of the time, and somebody who not only did everybody want to be around to be with, but to grow up to aspire to be like. And, she was, you know, certainly a very friendly type and somebody who, you know, never met a stranger and was very outgoing and had that California twinkle. And, you know, that really, especially during the Depression when there was so much to be, you know, depressed, if you will, about, she gave a lot of people a lot of hope and as a result became much more of an outsized figure than she might otherwise have been.
Right. You mentioned in your book that in 1977, when Wimbledon celebrated 100 years of champions, former champions were welcomed back to Wimbledon, although they had to pay their own way to get there. And Alice Marble actually had to turn to friends in order to raise enough money to make that trip. But I still remember the huge swell of applause when her name was announced and she walked out on that venerable court, one of the most honored women in the history of the game that she played so brilliantly. The book again is The Divine Miss Marble, A Life of Tennis, Fame, and Mystery, published by Dutton, the author Robert Weintraub. Robert Weintraub, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show and for giving the world such a fascinating book about the great Alice Marble. Thank you.
I agree. I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow on the morning show, I'm going to be speaking with best-selling author Rebecca Searle. Her many fans have been eagerly awaiting her next novel, and it's finally here, a really intriguing, deeply personal book called One Italian Summer.